Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to make products and technologies that populate our lives and make them easy and effective to use? And why are seemingly simple things sometimes difficult for smart people to figure out? We've all found ourselves pushing on a door that won't open or flipping the wrong light on as we approach a panel of switches. I, for one, have called down to more than one hotel front desk after puzzling over how to get the shower to turn on. Typically, we blame ourselves for these frustrating experiences, but as my guest today will tell us, the fault often lies not with a user too dumb to intuit the right way to use a product, but with a designer who made it too complicated in the first place. Don Norman is co-founder of the Nielsen Norman Group, which studies and consults on the user experience of products, applications, and websites. His 1988 book, The Design of Everyday Things, has just been revised and expanded and is available now. Don Norman joins us from the studios of Stanford University. Don, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You have long been an advocate for what you call human-centered design, or HCD. Will you explain what that means exactly?
Yeah, it's rather simple. It's, let's try to figure out what the people need, the people who actually use the products or services we're designing. And it's remarkable how few people do that. How many products are made by engineers saying, well, I know how people work. I'm a person myself. I always tell these engineers, you know, the problem is you're being too logical.
So in other words, you have to account for the fact that not everyone will follow the rules?
The rules. Whose rules? They turn out to be machine rules. I mean, that's how engineers think. You know, if it weren't for people, our stuff would work just fine. See, the engineers try to be logical. And I say, you have to take people the way they are, not the way you'd like them to be. And logic. We don't work by logic. Logic was invented. Some mathematician or actually philosophers invented logic. You know, if you study logic in school, it's a hard subject. If that's how we actually thought, it wouldn't be hard.
And, you know, we all love things that are particularly clever or elegant, but it turns out that the best designs sometimes are the ones that simply don't call attention to themselves. They just work for us.
Yeah. And that's actually one of the problems we face, is that when you do it right, people don't notice it. And so, therefore, it gets no attention, and you're not rewarded, you know, to do that again.
But it is funny when something doesn't work. I mean, we've all had the experience of, you know, you encounter a new digital alarm clock, and you really have to wake up the next morning. And sometimes it can be, you know, a long time trying to figure out what seems obvious to someone else.
Actually, there's a really simple answer to that. Don't use them. That's that's your cell phone is so much better. And that's an amazing point, that the alarms on the cell phones are pretty much easy to use and to understand, and they work well. Yet these expensive devices that we buy to put on our bedside, they're horrible.
What is the relationship, Don, between effective design and user empowerment?
I would define effective design one that empowers the user.
Well, let's talk about what's changed since you published the first edition of the book 25 years ago that made you want to go back and update it. Because I know that this has been sort of in constant use by people who are designing products. Why did you decide it was time to go ahead and add some new material?
Well, the book was written a long time ago, in 1988, 25 years ago. And the principles that are in the book are still true, because the principles are all about people. The way that people interact with the world, with technology and with, well, the whole world. Those haven't changed, but the technology has changed. So all the examples in the book, they don't hold anymore. I talk about slide projectors, and people say, what's a slide projector? You know, dialing your telephone, what's a dial? So I had to change it to update the examples, but several things have changed in the meantime in 25 years. First of all, I've changed. So when I wrote it, I was a professor at the University of California. And in the period, I was, well, vice president at Apple and executive at HP. And I began to understand the problems that people and companies faced. So it's not always their fault. And we can get into that later. A second issue is that the technologies have changed, and therefore with the way we apply the principles have changed. And I had to cover that. And finally, in the first book, it was all about making things understandable, and I left out emotion and pleasure and enjoyment. And that's really very, very important. So I made sure I added that in this book.
One other thing that you cover here that I thought was really interesting was feedback for the user of a product. It's pretty important when we press an elevator button or want to cross a street or are using something that we know that we've done the right thing to make it work for us.
Mm. You've watched people at elevators and they push the button and 30 seconds later they push it again and they push it again and again. And yeah, the button lights up, but it doesn't really tell you the elevator heard and it's coming. So you keep pushing and pushing. Yep, feedback is one of the most important principles. And you know what? Our computers were usually pretty well designed until we moved to this new generation of gestures. Gestures are fun and wonderful, but there's no feedback. You ever pick up a photo or something you want to show somebody on your tablet and hand them the tablet, and when you hand it to them, their fingers accidentally touch the surface, and so, whoop, it's not there. And there's no feedback. You have no idea what happened. The only way to get the picture back is to start all over again from the beginning.
Right,
that's really bad design.
We've all done that.
And we know better. The same companies used to do well.
Hmm. Do you think there's a sense among some designers that feedback is inelegant in some way?
No. I just think they don't think about it. Hmm. Most bad design comes from lack of thought.
Tell us a little bit about the process for a designer working on something new. What sort of thinking and modeling have to come before actually putting an idea into production?
Well, I'll tell you two stories. One is the way it ought to be, and second, the way it is. The way it ought to be, well, just like when you do a news story, you should do some research beforehand. You don't just sit down and start writing. You got to find out what really happened. And so in design, you should go out and watch the people, how they do their lives, what it is they're doing, where their problems exist. And we want to solve those problems and make their lives easier and better, more enjoyable. But that requires going out in the field and watching people. Then you come back with all these ideas and you say, let's try to figure out what the real problem is that we're trying to solve. Not the one that I was told to solve. That's often not it. It's what is the fundamental problem. And then after that, let's go and try a whole bunch of different solutions and figure out which one works. And we do that by mocking it up. We may just draw a picture and give it to people and ask them to make believe they're using it or make it out of foam or cardboard. And eventually, we keep making better and better models and we test them with people and we refine and make sure this really works. And then we finally go into production. Now, that, by the way, this principle works whether it's a service, whether it's a website, whether it's a physical product. The reality is, well, I invented a law, Norman's Law. The day the product team is assembled, it's over its budget and behind on its schedule. So there's no time. You're rushed, 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 rushed. And you have to hit the Christmas selling season, which means it has to be in the stores by November, which means it has to be to the distributors by October, which means it has to be seen by the buyers in September. And, oh, we don't have any time. And often it's a lack of time and pressures of the sort that lead to bad design.
When you talk about going out and observing people using things in the real world, that's different than bringing in a focus group and trying to figure out what's necessary there.
Absolutely. There are two groups in a company that work with the customers, and one of them is marketing and the other one is the designers. And we both want to understand the customer, but for different reasons. The marketing people want to know what do people really buy? And the designers want to know, what do people really need? What can we do to make them understand and love this product? Now, those are slightly different issues, and so we use different methods. Focus group tells you what people think. That's not the same as what people do. Worse, focus groups, you know, people are nice on the whole, so they tend to want to tell you what they think you want to hear. And on top of that, they don't really know how they go about their activities. If they tell you, you know, how I wake up in the morning and make my breakfast, and you have them repeat it over and over again till you get it right, and then you manage to get permission to go into their home and wait in their kitchen until they wake up and you watch them making breakfast, you didn't do it the way you told me. And they will say, oh, well, today is special. Well, every day is special. So, yeah, we really believe in watching, not asking.
To the extent that that is expensive and you want to maximize that time, are there particular methods for watching and observing really effectively, or is it something that simply just takes what I call big fat quantity time?
It's you can actually do it amazingly quickly. You don't need to study that many people. You're trying to really understand what happens. So we're talking a week or two. You know, lots of people would love to take 6 months, but the reality is in a week or two, you can get a tremendous amount of knowledge. And let me tell you that in the end, that saves money and time, because if you do it wrong and you discover this later on, it's very expensive to change.
How do the principles of testing design compare depending on whether one is dealing with, say, software or digital technology or an object like a lamp or a car dashboard?
Well, the fundamental principles are the same. Mm-hmm. You really want to watch people in real use. Don't bring them into the testing room, because when they're in a testing room, it's not their home. It's not their office. It's not their automobile. So you really have to go follow people. When you make a test, you want to go and as much as possible make it like their real life. Because when you ask somebody, oh, let me see how you would change the station on this radio while you're driving the car, well, that's a little bit right, but I'd like to just have them drive the car and do what they normally do, because it may turn out that their child says, oh, change the music, or they're trying to change the navigation system when someone says, let's change the radio. And all sorts of interruptions happen and things happen in the natural world that we would never recognize otherwise. Lots of products, by the way, are not badly designed when everything goes well.
Hmm.
The real trick to great design is that when it goes wrong, even in a simple way, it's not a problem. You say, oh, yeah, that's not right, and you know what to do to go into the right path. That's the trick.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because we all make mistakes as we go about our daily lives, and if we can either fix them quickly or at least have them not cause kind of an epic fail, then we're ahead of the game.
Yeah, look, in our normal lives, when we interact with each other, like you interacting with me now, we never say, error, wrong sentence. That never happens, because mm-hmm. when we don't say it right, we correct it. Or you don't understand what I said, you'll ask me a clarifying question. And yet our machines, well, the engineers think it's all very logical, and so they don't understand when we do it wrong. They don't help us. They give us error message. There should never be an error message. It should be something that says, I didn't understand. You know, this phone number has too many digits. And you can look at it and say, oh, and fix it.
One of the things, you know, you talk about watching people.
By the way, I have to interrupt because I have to give you one of my pet peeves.
Sure.
Which is websites and applications that ask you for passwords or phone numbers. And after you've figured it out and type it all in, then they say, oh, that's the wrong format.
You know,
password ought to have, you know, 16 characters, at least one blah, 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 or phone number. No, you're not allowed to use dashes or spaces or parentheses. So, hey, first of all, why don't you write the program so you'll accept any way I write a phone number? Or if you really insist on a format, why don't you tell me before I enter it, not after?
Don Norman is my guest. He is co-founder of Nielsen Norman Group, which studies and consults on the user experience of products, applications, and websites. His new book, actually his updated book, is called The Design of Everyday Things. It's been revised and expanded from the original, published in 1988, and it's available now. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning, and gift certificates are available at 214-768-CAPE or smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is co-founder of Nielsen Norman Group, Don Norman. His book, recently updated from the original 1988 version, is called The Design of Everyday Things. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we invite you to call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Don, going back to what you were saying about your frustration, which I think many of us have shared about websites that suddenly tell you that your password that you've come up with is not going to work, or the way you put in the phone number is not going to work, what kinds of thinking should go into when a design ought to be standardized across brands and experiences, and when a designer might be able to reinvent and maybe make something better?
Well, there are several different issues involved here. One of them is my comment that we should go out and watch people and understand how people really do things. If we actually did that, then some of the problems I mentioned would go away. In fact, if people just watch themselves, because I'm sure the people who program that have the same problem themselves when they go to other sites. The problem is, it's not the designer. The problem is, you probably was not a designer. It probably was the programmer. It probably was an engineer. So the first step is, let's get some real designers in here, people who are trained, who have this, you know, designers have wonderful skills, but one of the important things that you're taught in design school is empathy, to understand the people you're working with. And that's why we watch them and try to get a feeling. So even before we do standardization, let's think about how people actually behave. That would solve most of the problems we're talking about. The problem of standardization is an important one, and most of the things that we use every day have been standardized, but not the new stuff. It's always hard to standardize new stuff. First of all, there's a fear if you standardize too soon, we halt progress. Second of all, if you standardize too late, well, it's too late, because every company has their own way of doing and doesn't want to adopt to another way. And in the intermediate stage, like we are today with gestures on our phones and tablets and computers, well, each company has patented their own special way of doing things. And so one company does things and another company is not allowed to do it the same way, therefore preventing standardization. Now, in the end, there are ways of getting standards, and there are procedures for allowing standards even of patented mechanisms, but it's a really long haul. It's really hard. You wouldn't believe how many standards committees have been working. Take your automobile and those horrible stalks that come out of the steering wheel, every car being different. There have been standard committees working on this problem for, I think, 15 or 20 years.
And the problem is simply that no one can agree on what's best?
Yeah, no one can agree, and the technologies are changing. I was part of the standards committee that brought us high-definition TV. I was at the very end. I was at the political end. So I'm serious that lots of technical people had worked together and developed all these standards, and they had lots of standards, but it was all coming from the television companies. And I was a vice president at Apple at that point, and the computer company said, ooh, those are bad standards for television. That's great for television, but not for computer displays. And someday we would like the television display and the computer display to be the same. That's actually how it is today. So we wanted to have, pardon the technology, but we wanted non-interlaced square pixels. And that was a fight. And finally, the Federal Communications Commission got tired of the fight between computer companies and TV and said, we're going to lock you in a room and you're not going to allow to come out until you agree. So in some sense, I got locked in a room for 6 months, shuffling from city to city, locked in lawyers' offices, debating and arguing. Oh, it was horrible. We ended up with 16 standards. 16 standards. So you could choose among them, which meant essentially no standard at all. And the weird thing is, finally we adopted high-definition TV on these weird standards, and it took another 10 to 15 years before it actually became pretty, you know, well-used all across by everybody. And by then, the standards were obsolete, didn't matter. Yeah.
Well, I guess it was important to have people in the room who realized back in, I suppose, the late 90s that there would be an interest and a desire ultimately to play television content on computers, right? Because that wasn't available as a thing that long ago.
That's right. And the television companies, first of all, they couldn't conceive of it. And second of all, well, we don't make computers. We don't care. It wasn't helped, by the way, by the computer companies. One representative from a major computer company, one of my fierce competitors, actually, the fiercest competitor, the way he negotiated was he stood up at the very beginning and said, listen, folks, square pixels, non-interlaced, that's the future. That's what we need. And you're either going to do it or we're going to kill you. That's a great negotiation stage.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Pat calling from Austin. Hi, Pat.
Hi there. I had a question for your guest regarding usability and how that, and whether or not through design and usability, if you feel like that can help people in ways medically. And my example is, you used to hear about this term carpal tunnel syndrome, and I feel like in the 90s you heard about that a lot of people who worked with computers. And I feel like you don't hear that word anymore, and I was curious what the guests thought were about whether it was design or usability that have kind of helped us medically in a way. And I'll take my comments or the answers off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, absolutely. Making things more usable is really important for lots of medical issues. I actually thought you were going to go towards some of the instrumentation we use, where there's lots and lots of injuries caused by people misusing the medical equipment. The carpal tunnel syndrome is a different one. Basically, any operation that you do repetitively is going to lead to those kinds of problems. And so people, meat cutters have that problem. People working in factories have that problem. Musicians sometimes have to give up their professional career because the repetitive motions they're doing with their hands or fingers. Violinists often have this problem. So it's not related just to computers. With computers, it was mostly dealing with the typing, the typewriter. And basically, the real issue there is not the design of the computer systems. It has to do with the design of the workplace. First of all, you want the hands to be horizontal, which means that the height of the keyboard has to be adjusted depending upon how you are sitting. And second of all, you ought to take breaks. And finally, yeah, we don't hear it in the news anymore, but let me tell you, it's just as bad a problem as it ever was. Many, many people suffer from it.
So when you talk about, you mentioned medical devices and mistakes that can happen there. There, typically we want the things we use to be as easy to pick up and operate as possible. But there may be times when adding a layer of complexity actually focuses our attention on something that requires our full attention.
Yeah, want to give me an example? I can't think of any.
I'm trying to think of something that if we want to make sure, for example, that someone uses a bandsaw properly, you might put in some extra precautions into the design to make sure that it doesn't turn on until we have moved our hands out of the way or that sort of thing.
Okay, good example. Thank you. I call those forcing functions. Absolutely. When you deliberately make some things difficult to do. I wanted to make it so that I can't accidentally hit the switch that turns on the bandsaw. I may have to be holding something. And we also have guards on the bandsaw, which get in the way of the work a little bit, but they also prevent my hand from accidentally hitting the bandsaw. So it is quite often in safety-related work, we put covers over switches. We require that two buttons be pushed simultaneously. And in really critical issues, we often put those buttons far apart. So it takes two people to push the buttons simultaneously. So you're right. In dangerous situations, we try to make it difficult not to hit things accidentally. But I wouldn't say that was adding the kind of complexity we normally complain about. In general, I wrote a book called Living with Complexity, and I argued complexity is not a problem. Life is complex, and the tools that we make ought to be complex. They have to match life. What we don't like is complicated, when we get confused, we can't understand. Because if you take a look at anyone's kitchen, it's really complex. you can work in your own kitchen, but go to somebody else's and you don't know what to do. It's because understanding is in the mind. And when you know where everything is and how it works, it's simple. My kitchen is simple. So the real trick is to make complex things understandable. Not less complex, just understandable.
Years ago, I lived in an apartment that had the light switches at sort of waist height, almost where your hand would be naturally rather than lifting it up. And living there for a couple of years caused me, every time I walked into somebody else's house, to reach to that location to flip on the light switch. Can you talk about that's such a simple decision, and there are also light switches that sort of refer to things that we can't even find in the room, and how something that we take for granted often fails us in terms of it's not necessarily, they're not necessarily designed in an intuitive way.
One of the problems in homes and actually any building is that there are many, many different people who are involved in putting it together. And so an architect or somebody designs the building and then someone designs the interior. But then they call in, you know, they put in the doors, for example. But when they put in the doors, they don't really know who's going to be using the office or the building. And so the doors may not be in the right spot. They may not open the right direction. When the electrician is called in to put in the lights and the light switches, well, again, they don't really know who's going to be using it. So they do the best they can, and the tools they have are not really that great. So, you know, there's all these lights in the room. Okay, we'll put in six switches. And they go to the electrical store, and there's this box that holds six switches in a nice linear row, and so you mount the six switches. But, gee, which light goes to which switch? And lights are never in a nice linear row like the light switches. So there's a problem right there. And how high should it be? Well, actually, there are some standard heights, which is not the nice convenient height that you mentioned. So there, an electrician must have thought it through, or maybe the owner of the house thought that, well, children should be able to use a switch, or maybe a person in a wheelchair. But for whatever reason, that is not the standard that everybody uses. So I think one of the problems is just bad communication. The people who put on the hardware and doors don't understand how it's going to be used, and the people who put in the light switches are not the same people who designed the room. Hmm. And this lack of coordination is a major problem.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us at think@kera.org. Andrew writes, I just finished a master's degree in software, including a class on user interface design that introduced me to Mr. Norman's book. I was amazed to discover affordances in so many places I have never noticed. What work is being done to introduce this in more engineering curriculums, including undergrad? And maybe before you answer that, Don, you should explain to us what affordances are.
Ah, affordances. Surprisingly easy to talk about and hard to understand. And affordance is this relationship. I'm sitting in this little room, the studio, and there's a door, and it has a doorknob, and it affords grabbing. If you look at the shape of the doorknob, it fits the shape of my hand, and so I know that I can grab it and turn it. And so affordance is this relationship between an object in the world and the person, and the kinds of activities I can do. So I love to point out that with a box, a big enough box, I can lift it up, I can throw it, I can stand on it maybe. Depends how strong it is. Does it afford standing? Well, what's it made out of, wood or cardboard? And I can even hide behind it. So the affordance sort of says what's possible. And, yeah, one of the things I like about my book is it makes people see the world differently. They look around saying, oh, because I always ask the question, you always go into new rooms. You've never been there before, or new experiences, yet you've managed quite well. How do you manage to use things you've never seen before? Hmm. One of them is the clues that you get from these visible affordances.
And so, as to the question about whether are more undergraduates starting to study this book and the ideas in it?
The book has been received very well, so it's hundreds of thousands of people have purchased the book, and I presume more than that have read it. But it's amazing. Things have really gotten better over the years. In 25 years, a lot of devices are far better than they ever were. We're producing many more easy-to-use, understandable devices. The problem is the rate of technology is such that you know, as fast as people get better, it's even faster that things get worse, that new people come along that, well, didn't read my book or never took a course or they aren't really trained designers. And so as a result, yeah, lots of things are better, but even more things are, we didn't think about the person who uses it.
Do some of these improvements tend to happen first with high-end products and then filter down to things that are more affordable to the rest of us?
No, I don't think so. In fact, it could even be the opposite because a lot of times with high-end products, you get the wrong kind of designer. You get the designer who's an artist, a name designer who wants to make a name for themselves in this spectacularly beautiful, wonderful object. The fact that nobody can use it, well, you know, I paid a lot of money to say, hey, look at this neat thing I have. I can never use it, but it's wonderful.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Olivia in Colleyville. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone to whom I might have asked this question, so my reason for calling is the complexity of utilizing cable network controls and the various controls that are necessary to manipulate a television, a cable, all of the pieces. Why is there not more simplicity and standardization in that? Because there are those of us in my age group who find it very intimidating to utilize the whole array of technology anyway. And when you're trying to use something that's an everyday object that's so complex, I wonder why it is kept that way for so many years.
Well, Olivia, we have to take a quick break now, but we will get an answer for you when we come back. We're speaking this hour with Don Norman, who is co-founder of Nielsen Norman Group, which studies and consults on the user experience of products, applications, and websites. His book, The Design of Everyday Things, has just been revised and expanded. It's available in bookstores now. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning, and gift certificates are available at 214-768-CAPE or smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Don Norman. We're talking about his book, The Design of Everyday Things, which has just been newly updated and revised. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. And Don, before the break, we heard from Olivia, who was frustrated by how very complicated TV remotes have become.
Yep. Aren't they horrible? One of my favorite examples of really crappy experiences. You know, everything is wrong. Each individual remote is badly done. It's got far too many buttons, and they're arranged in some haphazard manner. They're arranged actually to save money, because you go out and you buy this little board that has several little holes in a rectangle, so all the switches are in this rectangular array, and they make no sense. And you know, the same company makes different remotes for, say, the DVD player and their TV set, and they're different. Crazy. And so they're trying to save money. It's usually done by engineers and not by professional designers. And in your living room or entertainment room, you have all these pieces of equipment made by different companies. And so they all work differently, and that's one of the major problems. It's really hard to understand how to control them and which ones turn on and turn off, and which you have to use, 10 different remote controls if you're unlucky. And even when you try to buy one that puts them together, well, the manufacturers keep the code secret. So you have to do a lot of underground sleuthing to figure out how you actually work them. and they often don't have the right. I can go on and on, as you can hear. There are no standards. They refuse to have standards. It's a mess, a complete mess. Now, it's interesting. Just the other day, I saw a wonderful remote control made by LG, the Korean company, and it was wonderful. It was really simple. It had just the kind of controls, just the few ones that you most often want to use. It fit the hand comfortably, and when you held it in your hand, not only was it well-balanced, but your fingers naturally fell, well, where they ought to fall to use the controls. So I actually wrote my friend, Kumpyo Lee, who used to be executive vice president of design at LG, and I said, "Did you do this?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Wow, hurrah, finally." But that was just one piece, and it's not enough because the TV set is only part of this whole puzzle, and the other parts are made by other manufacturers. The whole thing is a mess, and it's one I've been writing about and talking about and trying to correct for over a dozen years, and I see no hope of success.
Well, you know, I love this part of the conversation, Don, because I have never purchased a TV based on how the remote works, and yet maybe that's something we should all consider the next time we are at the electronics store.
Let me tell you, those manufacturers know that. Hmm. And so when you say, "Hey, look, we could do a better job," they say, "Well, that'll cost us another $5, and it makes no difference whether people buy the set.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Tom in the Colony. Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom. Are you with us? Okay, we will move on, and we will go to Steve in Abilene. Hi, Steve.
How you doing? One of the things that infuriates me is the automobile manufacturers. They repeatedly put safety devices in cars that are actually incredibly dangerous. To give you an example, Ford and Toyota make cars now to where if you leave the key in the ignition, even with the engine running, the doors will lock if you step outside the car. So in other words, you can't get back in your car at all. I mean, somebody could die of heat stroke or something waiting for a locksmith to show up. Why do they repeatedly do these things?
Oh, my. Actually, to make your story worse, people have died. There have been, first, dogs have died and children have died. Locked in the car accidentally, as you point out. I don't know why this particular problem comes up. I do know caveat is I'm working with some of the major automobile manufacturers on the design of the what's called the cockpit, the front controls, the inside controls in the car that are so frustrating and can actually be a danger because if you try to use them while driving, they distract you from the driving. And I think the car manufacturers face a problem not unlike the remote control companies that I talked about, that there are many, many different parts, each one designed by a different division, and in some cases designed by exterior companies, not by the car company. Almost every car company has suppliers that do a lot of these controls and put them in. For safety reasons, it's been decided that when you start your car, the doors automatically lock. Usually not when you just start it, but when you drive past a certain speed, but the doors are locked. That can make it difficult to get out. I don't know the reason for that one. My suspicion is it's safety related, and some safety organization decided that was the way to do it. There is a problem when you leave the car, and what's happening more and more is that you don't put the key into the car. You just carry the key in your pocket. When the key is in your pocket, if you leave the car then knows that you're not in the car. And that actually can help solve some of these problems. But the way it is today, if you leave the car in the ignition and you leave the car and shut the doors, the car has no way of knowing that you're not in the car. So I don't know the answer to your question. I think that some of it may come from lack of understanding, but a lot of it has to do with the incredible interactions of the way people behave, the complex equipment in the car, the safety regulations, and so on. But it's a really unfortunate situation.
There are some things, though, as you mentioned, you know, I guess some things get worse and some things get better. I think the introduction of the mute button to car stereos, often in the steering wheel itself, is pretty brilliant. Sometimes you just need to really focus, and you can do that in a second now without moving your hand.
Yeah, my favorite control on all remotes is the mute button. It ought to be front and center.
One thing that you worry about in modern design is that we're just adding too many features simply because we can, that people may not necessarily want, and that may ultimately keep us from performing the function that the device is really made to do.
Yep. It's called featureitis. It's a deadly illness. And every device over time gets more and more features added to it, even the most simple device. People love to talk about the simplicity of Apple's products. Yeah, well, the first year it's simple, and the next year they add more, and then they add more and more and more and more and more. And everybody does it. It's really a horrible experience. And it's driven by marketing. It's driven by this competitive urge. It says, ooh, our competitors have added these three features, and, oh, people will buy the competitor, and they won't buy us. So we have to add not only those three, but an extra two, just so we're ahead. And the worst part about the story is that it's true. How many times you've been in the store and you decide what you want to buy, and then the salesperson says, yeah, that's pretty good, but let me show you this. See, this one does everything the other one does, and it also does these other two really neat things. And you buy it. Now, you'll never use those two neat things, never in your life, and they make your life more complex, you know, more difficult. But in the store, you know, that may govern your purchase, and that's what the manufacturers look at. They look at how many things do they sell.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Mark in Dallas. Hello, Mark.
Hello, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
I had a question for your guest. It's actually funny. It was it kind of correlates with what he was just talking about with a surplus of features. It seems like sometimes products, especially lately, are released. Let's say an iPhone comes out and it has X amount of features. Okay, that's all fantastic. But then in 5 months, another iPhone comes out with minute changes, maybe extended battery life, different things. And it makes me wonder, would the company necessarily have already made those advancements and those developments by the time they released the first product, but they're kind of holding out? Is there maybe this fear of, you know, running out of new ideas on which to elaborate that kind of dictates that a product can be continually re-released and kind of modified and changed to make up for the time that they would otherwise be thinking of new ideas?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you first start designing a product, you think of all the different things it can do. And you say, well, let's not put it all in the first release. So you very carefully release it in stages. You release the first product, and then you're already designing the second product before the first one is even out. And so you're going to add those extra little features. And then you have a bunch of other features you're going to add later on. And with automobiles, and for that matter, inkjet printers, you put the fancy features on the most expensive model. And then the next year, you move them down to the lesser expensive model, and you add even yet more features to the most expensive model. So with time, the features come down in price, but even more features. Now, see, the problem is, if you sell food, people eat the food, so they have to buy more. If you sell a cell phone, oh my goodness, what if the phone worked really well and they would never need another one in their entire life? And so, yeah, we keep adding these features in the hope that will cause people to say, oh, I'm out of fashion. I don't have the latest phone. And they'll buy another one. It really goes against people's interests.
It is funny that, who would have thought 10 years ago that you would demand in your cell phone a high definition video camera, that you wouldn't buy a cell phone unless it had a high-definition video camera. Most of us don't walk around all the time taking video, but now it's something that we expect. I mean, is it good in a way that these products allow us to do things we didn't know we wanted to do?
Yes, and of course, no. But, you know, look, the cell phone is not a phone. In fact, most of my friends have cell phones, including me. I have a cell phone, and I hardly ever talk on it.
Right.
That's not what it's about. It's an entertainment device. It's a sort of a general-purpose computing device. And would I ever have thought I'd walk around taking lots and lots of videos? No. Or photographs of everything? No. But guess what? YouTube shows that lots of people like to take those photos, and it's amazingly useful. And it's amazing how powerful YouTube has become in being able to demonstrate things. From now, if I find a new food at a restaurant, and I wonder how to make it. It used to be I would have to try to find a cookbook. Now I go to YouTube and I see somebody demonstrating it. So it's, on the one hand, it really has helped our lives. On the other hand, yeah, it has really complicated our lives.
What does it take to design products that will work for a wide variety of individuals who may have not just different, educational backgrounds, but may come from very different parts of the world but expect to use the same product?
That's a really interesting question, because lots of the products that we make today are used all around the world, sometimes by millions of people. And I advocate there not to design for the people, because the people are so very different and cultures are so different. Design for the task. Understand that task and make it so that everything that you have to do makes logical sense for the task itself. And then people will master it. We all learn to drive. It seems natural, and the controls seem natural. We forget that in order to learn to drive, you have to take a course. And it takes a couple weeks to sort of master the beginning, and then you have to take an exam, which in some countries takes a year, often a year of study and practice to pass the exam. And then when you start driving, you're not any good for the first year. It takes a while. But nonetheless, we think, yeah, well, this is the way it ought to be, a steering wheel to go which direction, and something to make us go faster, and a brake to make us stop, and a few other simple controls, and we master it. The same with cameras are the same all around the world. The same with cell phones, the same all around the world. Even the typewriter, the QWERTY keyboard we use, which has all its weird quirks, that's basically the same keyboard used in many, many different languages with just minor exceptions. And the French use AZERTY, A-Z-E-R-T-Y, instead of Q-W, but it's essentially the same keyboard. So if you design for the task, people will learn it and accept it and be happy with it.
Are we getting better at designing users' manuals when they are absolutely necessary?
No, we're getting worse. And it's not because of the manual writers. The manual writers are really frustrated because basically at the very end of the product cycle, when the product is almost ready to be shipped, they're called in and said, quick, do a manual. And the way they explained it to me is their job is to make all the crazy ways this is designed, make it look like it was on purpose. And so they're not done well. They tend to just go through every little button and switch and say what it does, as opposed to say, how do you use it? What do you do? They should explain an everyday thing that you do with it. But there's no time. There's such an attempt to cut the cost down. In fact, today we seldom even put the manual in the box. It's on the website someplace. Or even when it's in the box, it's so hard to read because to save money, it's in 8 languages, and you have to go back and forth to find the language you want. They're not done well, but it's the fault of the manufacturer, the time pressures they give, and the fact they don't take that seriously because, just as we said before about remote controls, nobody buys a product because it has a great manual.
Don Norman is co-founder of the Nielsen Norman book, Norman Group, rather. We've been talking about his book, The Design of Everyday Things, which has just been revised and expanded. He joined us from the studios of Stanford University. Don, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.